Go for
Good
it.
evening, everyone. Thank you all for joining us tonight. It's great to see so many wonderful faces. I want to begin by thanking Shaare Shamayim for hosting this event tonight. And as you can tell, we are not doing this in person, but we hope to soon next year, God willing, in Jerusalem, or at least in Toronto, or if someone wants to sponsor in Florida, I'd love that. That'd be great too. I would like to thank my dear friends Raquel and Jason Goldberg for sponsoring tonight's event in the memory of their daughter Tamima. May her neshama have an aliyah. Let me begin by describing tonight's format. Each of us will present a Seder-ready Devar Torah, about 10 minutes in length. Point being that these ideas are ready for your Seder such that you will be able to use them at your disposal. And we will each speak about a specific part of the Seder and then hand over the mic to the next speaker. If you want more Pesach materials of our from Beit Midrash Zifron Dov, please do log on to torontotorah.com/Pesach. We have the recording of that last Haggadah night. We'll have this Haggadah night's recording, as well as many other Shiurim programs relating to Pesach. So please do check that out. I'd like to begin tonight's Divrei Torah with Yachatz. And Yachatz is the very beginning of the Seder. And so you can start off the discussion while some of you or members of your family may be chopping down on karpas, celery, parsley, whatever you have. And you can take a break from eating and introduce this Devar Torah. Now you may ask, what is exactly Yachatz? At this point, I'm going to share my source sheet once again in the chat. Hopefully the link will be accessible. If you do look at the source sheet, which I just shared, you'll see the Avadraham, who tells us that Yachatz is when we take the matzah, we split it into two, take a smaller piece that stays on the table, take the bigger piece, put it away, and that is the everyone's favorite part of the Seder, the Afikomen. The question is, why do we split the matzah, and why do we hide the Afikomen? Why do we put it away? And why is this splitting so significant that it's even one of the simanim of the Seder? So the Avadraham relates this to a Gemara in Psachim in source 115b, and rather page 115b, source number 2. I don't have that many sources. It's only a 10-minute presentation. But page 115b, in which the Gemara says that as the Torah refers to matzah as lechem oni, the bread of the poor, one of the interpretations of that is that someone who does not have much money receives a portion. They split it into two. It's beprusa, darko shaloni beprusa. The way of the poor is to split their bread into two. Therefore, we split the matzah into two. Additionally, Avadraham suggests the reason that we take the matzah, this other part of it, and hide it away is in reference to the matzah that the Jewish people carried over their shoulders as they left Egypt. But what is the significance specifically of the splitting? Why Yachas? The splitting is the simen. The Datz Akenim on Shemot 12:8 in source number 3 suggests that this relates to another important splitting around the time of the Seder, and that is the splitting of the Red Sea, Kriyas Yam Suf. And the splitting of the matzah is meant to remind us of the splitting of the Red Sea. Why would we specifically mention the Kriyas Yam Suf at this point in the Seder? Really, I'm not 100% sure. But you may consider asking this to the members at your Seder table, why they think Kriyas Yam Suf is so significant. There is another approach, and that is that of Natali ben Shimon Hertz Ginsburg. And his Haggadah is Natali Sivaratzon. And he says that what we're splitting on Seder night when we split the matzah, when we do Yachatz, is we're splitting the miracles of the night. He quotes a Midrash, a Medrash Rabbah, which comments on the Pasuk describing Avraham. Avraham Avinu in his war against the four kings when he went to save his nephew Lot. In that, in describing that, the Torah says, Vayechalek Alehen Laila, he split the night against them. And the Medrash says that that night was Pesach, and that night's miracles were split into two. The first miracles being for that of Avraham Avinu, and the second miracles being for that of the Pesach story, that of the Exodus. And to commemorate that splitting of the miracles, we split the matzah into two. Natali Sivar Ratzonam, Natali Ginsburg continues in this notion and notes that on the Seder, we also split our focus. The beginning of the Seder, we focus on the past. We focus on what happened to us, the Exodus. But the end of the Seder is for another miracle, that of being the ultimate final redemption. And to commemorate this, we also split the matzah such that the miracles of Pesach don't end with the miracles that happened in the past, but they will also continue with the miracles that will happen in the future. And that's why we take the afikomen and hide it away, because there's some of that miracle, a part of that miracle is still waiting to be realized in the future. And that's what we hide away. There's another approach suggested by Rav Nachman of Breslov, the student of the Rav Nachman of Breslov from the 18th century. And he suggests that the notion of splitting means that we're not complete on the night of the Seder. After all, we have not yet received the Torah. We're still lacking a certain spiritual prowess. And therefore, we need God's help. And he connects this to the notion of the other interpretation of the word lechem oni, poor man's bread. The Gemara also interprets as lechem she'onin alav dvarim harbei, the bread upon which we recite many things. And says Rav Nachman of Breslov in source number 5, that in order to receive a salvation from God in the night of the Seder, before we receive the Torah, because we're incomplete, we need to pray. We need to rely on God's rachamim, his mercy. And to commemorate this notion that we're incomplete, that we need God's help, that we have chisaron, deficiencies, we split the matzah. To highlight those deficiencies and to highlight the fact that we indeed need God's mercy. But I'd like to focus and end with the approach of Avram Yitzchak, a Kohen cook. And his approach, this notion of yachas, this notion of splitting the two matzot. When we split the matzah, there's really two different perspectives going on here. The matzah that we eat at that moment, as I recited before, is lechem oni. It's poor man's bread. Ma darko shel ani beprusa, right? The approach of a poor man to eating matzah, to eating anything, is to split it, to save it for later. However, the approach of eating the afikomen is much different. We eat the afikomen at the end of the meal, specifically after we're full, when we no longer need to eat. And Rav Kook suggests that these two pieces of the matzah represent two different approaches to eating. Now, on the one hand, sometimes we eat because we're ravenously hungry. Right? Imagine that you're going to a shul, maybe not Shari Shemayim, of course not, but another shul, and davening takes a very long time, and you finally get home to make kiddush, and you have that first bite of the challah, you're hungry, you just want to get it down. That's one type of eating. There's another type of eating. You're at the end of the meal, and you're full already. You're not too hungry, but there's that last dish that you really were looking forward to. Maybe it's the last piece of steak. Maybe it's dessert. And that is another type of eating, what Rav Kook refers to as an eating of delight, of pleasure. Now, believe it or not, Rav Kook suggests that the second type of eating, not eating for satiation, but eating for pleasure, is more dignified. It's more elevated. And that's because at this point, you're eating to gain a certain harchavat hadat, expansion of the mind. Think that you have that chicken soup or that shulent, and you're happy and you're full and you're thinking and contemplating and you're at ease and you're singing some songs. That's a different type of eating. And that's the type of eating represented by the afikomen. Now, why do we split the matzah? Says Rav Kook, because not everyone is able to think so deeply about eating. Some people eat because they're hungry. And that's okay. We don't need to jump to that second level right away. And even those people who have reached the level whereby all of their eating is this at this elevated status, they've reached this high level, but they should remember that not everyone's at that level. And it's okay to just eat because you're hungry too. But eventually you put these two together, because the point of eating ultimately is to reach this level of spirituality, that everything we do is to bring us to a higher level of spiritual consciousness. And therefore we split the two matzos, remembering these two types of eating represented by yachatz and ultimately the afikomen are both necessary, and that we should appreciate everyone in their particular level of spiritual prowess. So in reviewing, our question was, why is it that we split the matzah? What does that represent? And we suggested that it relates to this notion of lechem oni, that the bread of the poor who eat their bread in portions. We also suggested that it might commemorate the splitting of the Red Sea, Kriyas Yamsuf. Further, we noted that it commemorates the double focus of Seder night, both in the past and on the future. It represents our deficiencies and that we need the help of God. And it also represents these two types of eating, an elevated eating and a normal eating, just because you're hungry. And both are okay. Both are legitimate. We have to appreciate everyone, but hopefully we can all get to a place where we can use everything that we do to uplift our spiritual consciousness and get closer to God. Thank you very much. I hope you all enjoy Yachatz, the Seder, and I will turn the mic over to my good friend, Rabbi Chaim Metzger.
Thank you very much, Razami. For all those who are joining now, Just want to mention that this program is dedicated by Rachel and Jason Goldberg in memory of their daughter Tamima Allah Shalom. I'm placing the source sheet in the chat, and we will be picking up right after Or HaShem, we'll be picking up at the beginning of Magid. So I'm going to be asking a general question, then I'm going to be outlining what way to answer it, and hopefully that'll be something you can add to your meals, to your Seder nights as well. So my question to everybody is, when does Pesach actually start? I'm asking for the audience to answer here. I know it's risky. When does Pesach start?
On the night of the 14th of Nisan.
Right? Night of the 14th, I heard from Rasami. Any other guesses?
Tu B'Shvat is when we start planning Haggadah night.
Rosh Chodesh.
Rosh Chodesh. The first of Nisan, because that's when you select the sacrifice.
Right, when you start selecting the sacrifice. Good. We're all mentioning times that are earlier than when? The night of the Seder. So that's what I'd like to ask. So let's start with that. So when did the preparations for the Seder start? So it's the first start of the process actually corresponds to one of the four parsha that we just read, namely Parsha Para. The parsha about the red heifer, about the purification process of becoming impure and then becoming pure again. So we actually started this weeks in advance, not just because of the choosing of the animal, because you yourself were not yet fit to even bring the Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb. Because if you're Tameh, if you're ritually impure, you can't offer it. So that was the first thing we have to bear in mind, is that things started earlier. But not only that, the actual Korban Pesach started on the 14th during the day. We had to start by slaughtering the lamb on the 14th in order to get ready. So now my next question for everybody is, I'm going to try and bring us back to what was it like when we used to offer the Korban Pesach. The last time this happened was during the time of the Second Temple. So if you look in the sources, you will see I have two sources there. One is The one is Josephus, where he's mentioning what he remembers from before the destruction of the temple. He mentions how many Korban Pesachs were brought, how many lambs were brought, and he says 256,500 lambs, which roughly works out to be around 10 to 20 per person. Somewhere around 5 million people were at the Pesach ceremony. And in case you're thinking, why that seems like quite a lot, the answer is that's one of the least impressive ones that they had, right? That was an average year. What actually used to go down on Pesach was, if you look at the source in the Gemara of Pesachim, they actually had, they once did this in the time of King Agrippa, he wanted to know how many people were there, and they checked by counting the number of kidneys, and they found that there was 600,000 different kidneys, taken one from each of the korbanot, which means that there were, since it was two times 600,000, he got 1.2 million kidneys that were collected. And each Korban Pesach was joined in by at least 10 people. So that means there was at least 12 million people, possibly up till 24 million people, were participating in the Korban Pesach in the Beit HaMikdash. So many people might be a little confused as to, wait, 24 million Jews? That's more Jews than there are in the world today. And that's true. But how did they all fit? Well, one answer is that it's a miracle. But there's another option, is that they actually had to expand the borders of various parts of Yerushalayim, both of Har HaBayit as well as of Jerusalem itself, in order to have all people actually be physically standing in Yerushalayim when they offer the Korban. So now we know just how many people and how packed it would have been. Some people here may have been at the Kotel, when they do Birkat Kohanim, And there's 500,000 Jews in one place, is what they've got, is I think the highest number that they've had in recent years. So now try multiplying that times, 40 or 50, and then you're approaching what the Korban Pesach would have been like in terms of crowdedness and number of people. It even makes, if anybody happened to have been to Woodstock, that also makes Woodstock look quite small as well. So now I'd like to bring us forward a little bit. Now we're actually, all these people are here, and now it's time to go up to bring your Korban Pesach. So when you're bringing the Korban Pesach, not everybody can go in. Only the person who's actually bringing the lamb could actually end up fitting into the Beit HaMikdash. And even so, it took three whole shifts in order to get everybody in there. And these were shifts that were jam-packed. They had probably around 1 million people in each of them. And what they would have in order to accommodate, the Kohan were practicing all year long with their, to be properly able to receive the various sprinklings that they're going to have to do on the Mizbeach. And they pass it back and forth in rows of silver and gold as they bring it all towards the Mizbeach. Because whenever you offer a sacrifice, it has to be sprinkled on the Mizbeach. For more on that, let's hear for another time. Again, that's what they're all doing. And they're all there. And while this is going on, the Levim are leading the people in Hallel. Right? So everybody's together and they're singing. And what time of day is it? It's still only the 9th or the 10th hour on Erev Pesach. We haven't, it's on the 14th still, not even the 15th yet. And everybody's there, everybody's singing, everybody's together. And the day's just getting started. As we continue on, as each group would then leave, they would then start roasting their Korban Pesach, which would take them several hours. It takes 3 or 4 hours to roast an entire lamb whole. And while doing so, they would happily start discussing what was going to go on later that night when they're actually going to be eating the lamb and actually fulfilling the mitzvah of the Korban Pesach. But that wasn't the highlight of the evening. The highlight of the evening came not in the preparation, not in the largest barbecue where everybody's all joined together, but rather it comes while everybody's finally has enjoyed their meal. And now, once they've finished eating, now it is finally time for them to sing Hallel. All the Jews from all across Israel and beyond that have came for Pesach, have came to Yerushalayim, they're in their groups. And what do? They all start saying Hallel. People here may have been at the Siyum HaShas, back when we were still allowed to have massive gatherings. It was the last large gathering that I went to prior to, meeting gathering more than, 100 people that I had been to. And again, thousands of people. If you've ever been in a place like that at any stadium, the stadium is rocking. Now imagine it's not just your stadium with, maybe 80,000 people, but it's a whole city with 25 million people all cheering, singing, celebrating at the same time. What effect did that have? So the Gemara of Sachem says that how great was the song and the singing? It was so great that it seemed like the walls and all the roofs and all of Jerusalem were about to break. They were all shaking because that's how loud everybody singing and celebrating was. That is what we hope to celebrate once again. That is when we say, what was the Korban Pesach like? What is it really like to be celebrating a Seder? That is what the Seder is supposed to be. Hopefully someday soon we will be able to merit to see that. But in the meantime, we should, when we celebrate our own Seder, we should try to remember what the Seder could have been and will once again hopefully be when we are able to fully celebrate with the built Beit HaMikdash in the third temple.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that's just a summary.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, quick summary. So the question is, we're telling that Magid. So the question is, what are we supposed to tell about? We're supposed to tell about what the Korban Pesach was and the miracle, but it's also useful to give context of what this Seder night and how it would have placed as part of the overall Pesach holiday, how it would have played out during the Beit HaMikdash. Well, yes, oftentimes it's hard to to conceptualize it, but hopefully through the sources I've given, hopefully it'll help people to some context for what one day when we're able to celebrate all together in Yerushalayim, what it'll be like. Now on to Rabbi Tershier.
Thank you very much, Rav Chaim. I'm sorry for jumping the gun before. I was trying to figure out how you got to the 24 million. I was not clear on that, but that's something that we'll have to discuss later. Because I got my 10 minutes. So welcome, everyone. Thank you very much for participating in Haggadah Night number 2 for the year. Yep, that will be me. Hang on. So I want to thank Shai Shemayim for, again, partnering with us. This is year 6, and especially to thank Raquel and Jason Goldberg for their 6th year of dedicating this Haggadah Night in memory of their daughter Tamima, Aleha Shalom, and her neshama should have an aliyah. So we've been moving along in the Haggadah, and this Dvar Torah is going to explore a simple but, I think, eternal message of the Egypt experience. This Dvar Torah belongs really in Maggid at the start of what I think of as the essence of the Maggid, meaning we already finished talking about leaving Egypt. So the Manishtana, the stories about other people telling the story, the debate about when you're supposed to tell the story, all that's done. We said that our ancestors started out as idolaters and descended to Egypt and Vahisha Amda, and every generation Hashem has protected us. At this point, probably we've spilled a couple of drops of wine here and there as well by accident, as opposed to the intentional ones later. And then we say, Tsei Ulamad. Go out and learn what Lavan the Aramean tried to do to our ancestor, Yaakov. And we introduce the section from the book of Devarim, which summarizes the Egypt experience. Our ancestors went down to Egypt. They became many. The Egyptians harmed us. We cried out. Hashem brought us out to return us finally to our land of Israel. And here's the question in a nutshell. If you take a look at the source sheet, and again, the link is in the chat, you'll see the beginning of that Tse Ulamad paragraph. Go out and learn what Lavan the Aramean sought to do to Yaakov, our father. Pharaoh only decreed a death sentence upon the males. Lavan sought to uproot the whole people. As it says, an Aramean tried to destroy my father. He descended to Egypt. He dwelled there in small numbers, and there he became a large, mighty, and great nation. So first of all, the Haggadah is taking the view that an Aramean tried to destroy my father is the proper English translation of Arami Oved Avi. There's a lot of debate about how to read that sentence, but the author of the Haggadah is taking the view of the Ritva, the view of the Avudraham, that this sentence is saying, Lavan the Aramean tried to destroy our father. Okay, but this is my problem now. I know the Lavan story. And for anyone who may need a refresher on the Lavan story, I put it in source number 2 on the sheet. Lavan did an awful lot of bad things. He made Yaakov work for him for 7 years to marry Rachel. He swapped Leah for Rachel without informing Yaakov. He then made Yaakov work another 7 years for Rachel. He tried to cheat Yaakov of his salary. And he pursued Yaakov until Hashem finally said, leave Yaakov in peace. Okay. But how did any of that lead to Yaakov descending to Egypt? What does anything in there have to do with Yaakov going down to Egypt? I'm willing to accept he tried to uproot everybody, however you read that. But where does Yaakov end up sending, where does Lavan end up sending Yaakov down to Egypt? To make matters worse, I'll show you just a very interesting comment in source number 3 from a fellow by the name of Harry Friedman, who says, you know, Lavan is certainly a trickster. He tricks Yaakov into marrying Leah instead of Rachel. He changes Jacob's wages 10 times. But being a trickster is not so unusual in Genesis, he writes. And then he asks, why is Lavan singled out for special treatment? After all, as the father of Rachel and Leah, he is as much an ancestor of Israel as is Isaac. Right? Think about that one for a little bit. He's not truly. It depends a little bit on the Medrash about whether Bilhah and Zilpah are daughters of Lavan. But you get the point. We're pinning the descent to Egypt on somebody who was an ancestor of the Jewish people. What is this about? And I think the answer will highlight a vital pattern in Jewish history with lessons for all of us. To understand how Lavan led to Egypt, we need to contemplate what nation building is about.
What makes a national identity? So that's a fraught question today in an increasingly xenophobic world. It's also a little bit of a difficult question in a nation that is as avowedly multicultural as Canada. But let's see what we can do with this. What does it take to form a national identity? Well, in source number four, I brought you from the writer Alvin Powell, quoting Francis Fukuyama, saying that what you need in order to build a nation is a shared sense of national identity built on elements that tie people together. Shared culture, shared language, shared history. You need certain elements in common. There's actually a Pew study, which I found very interesting, linked in source number five. It talks about how Americans, Europeans, Canadians, Australians, and Japanese see the essence of national identity. Very interesting read. I would add another element, though, to Fukuyama's list of elements that contribute to a national identity. I think a lot of it is, as Ernest Gellner said, I brought it in source number six, nationalism. A sense of association with the nation helps to bring people together. You have to have a sense of being part of a community. And Fukuyama himself said that in an article in Foreign Affairs in 1995. I brought it for you in source number seven. You need that sense of being one. And Lavan undermined that sense of being one among ourselves. How? By swapping Leah for Rachel. See, I don't think Lavan is trying to accomplish this. Lavan's goal in introducing Leah is just free labor, right? That's what Lavan wants. Lavan wants Yaakov to work for him for another 7 years. In his mind, I don't think it's free labor in Leah's mind, but in Lavan's mind, he's getting another 7 years out of work for, from Yaakov. But that stunt of putting Leah into the relationship triggers an enduring split for the Jewish people. It leads to the addition of Bilhah and Zilpah in the race for children and ultimately the birth of 12 sons and at least one daughter. It leads to strife, splits within Yaakov and his wives, with Rachel lashing out at Yaakov because she doesn't have children when Leah does. Rachel acquiring those Dudaim mandrakes from Leah. Leah responding, hey, he's my husband. What are you trying to pull here? We stop viewing ourselves as one nation, and instead we identify based on our different mothers. And that leads to the existence of multiple camps among Yaakov's children and their descendants, such that as the story plays out, we find when the children of Yaakov meet Esav, each one is grouped with their own mother. We find Reuven moving Yaakov's bed from Bilhah's tent over to Leah's tent. We find Yosef hanging out with the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. Friedman may be right that Lavan is our grandfather, but he created a terrible schism that began among our nation's founders and continued from there. And now I turn to an idea from Rav Zalman Saratskin in his Haggadah Hashir V'Hashevach. He says, he doesn't bring the part about Lavan, but he says, Hashem sent us to Egypt for us to learn the tools to form a more perfect union. He quotes the sentence in Mishlei in Proverbs, which I brought you in source number eight, V'ach letzara yivaled. A brother is born from trouble. Your friend will be like a brother to you when you are in trouble. We learned unity, or we were supposed to learn unity in Egypt. We were supposed to learn even a sense of commonality that would lead to support for a common government. And when we had learned unity, it was time to go. So that the Torah says, Vanitzak, we cried out to God, and Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin in source number nine says, we cried out to God together. We stood in prayer together. You have the Shotrim in Egypt. The people the Egyptians had appointed as slave drivers refused to hit their brethren, other Jews. They absorbed the blows meant for their brethren. Paro punishes the Jews for Moshe's protests. He removes their straw. The Jews yell at Moshe, but they don't betray him to Paro. Rav Zalman Sarutskin says the point was for us to learn that unity. And he says we take that message with us via matzah and its symbolism. You have raw flour and you have water, items that naturally spread and flow apart, but we mix them together. If you mix them together and then allow them to rise again, they spread apart, but we halt the process in the middle. After they are these separate ingredients that flow apart, and before they can rise and spread apart, the moment when they stick together, that's when we eat them. We freeze them in that position as matzah. That's what Sorotkin's image for the unity we were supposed to learn. Now, the truth of the matter is, this is a bit more complicated because the Torah does preserve tribalism. You can't get away from the fact that the Torah preserves tribalism. We have the flags of representing each tribe. We travel as tribes in the wilderness. We had our own identity as separate tribes. Even when we went through the sea is split into channels. Each tribe travels on its own. There is preservation of tribal identity. And in source number 12, I gave you a link to two sessions of mine in which I talked about why we want to preserve tribalism. It is there. Lavan succeeded at a great price for us because it was what caused us to go down to Egypt in the first place. So to sum up where we're, this raced a little bit, this quick idea. We're asking, how did Lavan's actions lead to our descent to Egypt? And our answer is Lavan introduced tribalism into the Jewish people by marrying off Leah to Yaakov. That tribalism split the children of each wife from each other, led to the sale of Yosef, and so brought us down to Egypt. And according to Rav Sorotzkin, in Egypt, we were supposed to learn that unity and trust which cement a nation together like we saw from Fukuyama and Gellner. We may be tribes, but we have to see ourselves as one. And I conclude with the beautiful words of Rabbi Chiel Michel Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan, in his introduction to the section of Choshen Mishpat. He talks about how he valued diversity in Torah. And he says, Moshe called the Torah a song. And he writes, the splendor of a song is when the voices are different from each other. That is the essence of its appeal. Lavan was onto something. We became tribes and that had value. However, we still have to be one song. We have to see each other as one. And that was a lesson we were meant to learn in Egypt. And it's a lesson we still need, I think, to learn and preserve today. Thank you very much. I turn over the floor to Rabbi Hecht.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Turchiner. And I also wanted to express my appreciation to Shari Shemayim and to Raquel and Jason Goldberg for dedicating this Haggadah night in memory of their daughter, Tamima, Alea Shalom, and Meir Torah, learning serve as an aliyah for her neshama. So moving forward in the Seder, so we're now closer to the meal, closer to the second cup, and we are entering the point leading up to Hallel where we say that in every generation, and I'll just put my source sheet in the chat, we say that in every generation, one is required to view oneself as if one is personally or has personally left Egypt. So in practice, it's a little bit hard because it's hard to get to Egypt. And if we're leaving anywhere, you know, we have to ask questions and do we have to quarantine when we get back? It's not so simple to leave and go back from anywhere. But I just I'll pose a question at your Seder. How do you feel like you leave Egypt? Do you feel like you're leaving Egypt? How do you relate to that part of the Haggadah?
We usually talk about the things that other people do at their Seder to commemorate leaving Egypt and to act like they're leaving Egypt.
To act like, okay, so that works too. And we'll see that has a basis to conduct oneself like they're leaving Egypt. But it's a difficult thing because, again, it's not necessarily our experience, it would seem. But it's clear, everyone sees this source sheet in the chat, it's clear that it's not only a nice thing to do at the Seder, to view themselves as if they left Egypt, but it's actually a requirement. The source in the Haggadah is from Mishnah Pesachim. It's the source number one that says, "V'kol d'vader chayev adam liros has atzmo ki'ilu hu yatza mi'Yitzrayim," that a person is obligated to view oneself as though he left Egypt. And this is from the Torah, "V'gadad l'vincha b'yomahu le'mor," you should tell your child on that day, "Bavor zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeisi mi'Yitzrayim." It is because of this which Hashem did for me when I came forth from Egypt. And where it shows that there's an obligation on Seder night to view and relate to the Exodus as if it were, or if it is, a personal event. Now, again, how are we supposed to do this? How does this play out? If we have an obligation, there must be a way that we're able to fulfill it. So there are many explanations, but the limited time we have now, I want to present one explanation from Rabbi Shimon Schwab. Rabbi Shimon Schwab gives the analogy of when he was a young child, he had spilled a cauldron of scalding water on his arm, and his skin peeled off, and it says it took months for him to heal. So both with the skin replacing itself, the skin cells replacing themselves, and just generally, since that event as a child, his arm healed, he grew older, his appearance changed, but he could nevertheless look back and say, he could stick out his arm and say, this was the arm that was burned when I was a child. Meaning there's nothing inconsistent about that and the current situation. He's still the same person. It's still the same arm, despite having undergone significant change. And he says, this is the same as the Jewish nation. The Jewish nation, Rav Schwab says, is a living organism made up of all generations of Jews. He says that the Klal Yisrael that was redeemed from Egypt is the same Klal Yisrael that exists today. The old cells of our ancestors have been replaced with new cells, us, their descendants. And each one of us is part of the great organism of Jewish humanity that emerged from Egypt. And he says, thus every person can truthfully declare that the Klal Yisrael of today left Egypt and I was among them. So it shows that our identity on Seder night is really one of being part of the Jewish nation. And even though that Jewish nation has undergone different changes, has looked differently throughout the years, it's still that fundamental, it's fundamentally the same nation that left Egypt. And therefore, we can say we're part of that nation that left Egypt. And therefore, Schwab says that is a not just hyperbole, but a factually true statement. Similarly, look at source number 3, the Nesiva Shalom says that the experience of the Exodus is renewed on Seder night. And he says that Seder night has two aspects. One, the historical Exodus, that similar to Schwab, says that our souls were there, an aspect of us was there. And secondly, that the experience of the Exodus is something that on Seder night, we experience and we undergo the same type of experience as the Exodus from Egypt. So we could say that the different ways of understanding it are nice to maybe shed light on this perhaps difficult passage in the Haggadah. But what difference does it make practically? How are we supposed to respond by viewing ourselves as if we are leaving Egypt? So, and to pose another question, what do you think? If we're leaving Egypt right now, or if we view ourselves as if we had personally left Egypt, how would we respond? How would we act? What would we be thinking?
You'd probably be quite happy.
You'd probably be happy, right? It'd be more than just I'm reading a story. Oh, look, I'm looking at the itinerary, I'm looking at the events that happened. We'd probably express, or at least feel, but probably also express great emotions of joy. And the Rambam emphasizes this. He changes the wording slightly. He says that not just the person is supposed to see themselves as if they left Egypt, but he says he puts it really in the present tense. In source number 4, he says, "The cold over there, Chayim Adam Laharos, to conduct himself or to demonstrate as Asmo Kiilu." Who ba'atzmo, and he emphasizes the personal, that he himself, Yotza Ata Mishibud Mitzrayim, is emerging right now from the servitude of Egypt. And therefore, this demands an appropriate reaction for what that event signifies. And if you look at source number 5, it's a continuation of the Mishnah that was cited in source number 1. And I don't know if I'll ever have the privilege of publishing a Haggadah, but I find sometimes the ways Haggadahs are published, you lose the flow a little bit, because there's this statement that you're supposed to see yourself as if you left Egypt. And there, and then it says, lefichach, therefore. Lefichach is usually printed as in a separate paragraph, but it's really a continuation. We're supposed to view ourselves as if we are leaving Egypt. Therefore, therefore, we're obligated to praise Hashem for that, meaning that that recognition imposes on us or and results in the obligation to respond to that. And the that response, that relation to the Exodus is different than at any other time during the year where we're also required to remember the Exodus. If you look at source number 6 on the second page, Soloveitchik said that just remembering the Exodus doesn't necessarily cast upon oneself the obligation to necessarily respond or recite any types, express any types of gratitude or celebration. You know, if we reminisce about something that happened to our ancestors, we can look back with appreciation, but it doesn't necessarily demand that we respond in the same way. But from the way that we're conducting ourselves on Seder night, that we're actually going out from Egypt, therefore, this results in the obligation for us to praise and thank Hashem. And he says this is the basis for the obligation of reciting Hallel at the Seder. Now, Hallel at the Seder is unusual. It's unusual because it's for several reasons. And one of the ways that it's unusual from other times generally that we Hallel is recited is that in the Hallel that we say at the Seder, there's no bracha preceding it. So why is there no bracha preceding it? We just saw it says it's, we saw the bishul fikachanachu chayav and lahodos, etc. That we're obligated to praise Hashem. If we're obligated to do it, so why is there no bracha? And Rabbeinu Haigon in source number 7 says that we don't recite a bracha asher kishenem esetav itzvano. It says ligmor as a hallel to upon the recitation of hallel because we're not saying this hallel is a formal recitation. We're saying it in the category, he says, of a shira, of song, of a spontaneous expression of our joy in this moment. And because that's the context that we're reciting Hallel in, it's inappropriate perhaps to make a bracha before, that this is supposed to be the natural response. So just to sum up, that Seder is a time to inculcate not only our connection with history, but also recognize that we are actors in our history. We're part of the history of the Jewish nation, which every year on the 15th of Nisan leaves Egypt. So hopefully this Pesach, we should take that opportunity to recognize and tap in to the tremendous joy of the occasion and sing and celebrate and appreciate that we're part of that eternal Jewish people. Chag Kasher V'Sameach.
Chag Kasher V'Sameach, everybody. Thank you very much for participating. As Rav Sammy said in the beginning, you can find more Pesach resources at torontotorah.com/Pesach, including a link for this year's Seder Companion, which you will also be able to find hard copies of, God willing, at your respective shuls this coming Shabbos.